Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017 number 5, and this is with Mark Collette. Hello, Mark.
Hello, it's great to be here, and it's fantastic to finally get a chance to work with you.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I don't know when I first became aware of you. I think it might have been a year ago. When did you start the channel your own channel as it is today? When did you start building it?
Just over a year ago. I did a video actually about you when you got doxxed, and I remember saying that, like, at the time I was, you know, waiting to see how you reacted to it, and in the end you reacted in a really honorable and sort of fist pumping way. So I was right behind you there, because when these things happen, the important thing is to show our enemies that we're not going to bow to them. We're not going to give up. We're not going to run away. We're not going to squeal or cuck out. And you didn't. And I think the fact that you didn't, I obviously said in my podcast that I was really proud that you came back. And, you know, that was a really, really good message for all your followers, for all nationalists. And, you know, I take my hat off to you, because I've been through all that myself before. I mean, we never got doxxed because when we stood in elections, we had to have our addresses made public anyway. So I've been in the situation where I've had my house attacked. I've had my, you know, BMW sprayed up with swastikas by the enemy. I mean, that's obviously really, you know, quite something. You drive down to Asda, your car's covered in swastikas, but you're just picking up a 4-pinter. It's quite a sight.
Well, indeed. I mean, I don't want to talk too much about that, because I always think, I mean, I said what I wanted to say at the time, and I don't want to fixate on it too much. But yeah, it was obviously nothing like that had ever happened to me before. There are things I would do differently if I had my time again. But of course, you know, it can only happen once, so I won't get another chance. And I mean, at the time, it was just very strange and scary. It was stressful. But I mean, that's exactly what they're trying to do to you. That's exactly, and what's so disgusting is that they'll pretend that it's for the public's, and like, it's for the public's benefit that they're doing this, that they're showing up at your house. And it's absolutely not. I mean, it's just the most low-grade reporting, the most low-grade tabloid bullshit. That's why they're doing it. Or it could even be ideological. I never knew, I still don't know to what extent it was just tawdry, cheap reporting, and to what extent it was ideological. They're actually, you know, ideological leftists. But one way or the other, it was a very, I just think it's shitty, and I think they reveal themselves to be shitty organizations and shitty individuals.
Well, it's more than that. Let me explain. What they try to do is they pick on people, and then they try to make that person squeal. They try to sort of essentially make that person run. Because once one person runs, once one person squeals, once one person leaves the movement in a big sort of flustery mess, other people leave, because fear breeds fear. But when somebody stays strong like you did, that breeds defiance, that pulls people together, that galvanizes your support, and that makes people stand strong. It's basically the old military tactic of getting a rout going. If you get people fleeing from the battlefield, the fear and panic spreads, and you get a full-scale rout. And believe me, when you're running away, that's when you're easily or most easily cut down, and that's the problem with a rout. If people stand and fight, no matter what the odds, they're more likely to survive than they are when they're routed, because when they're running away, when their backs to their enemies, that's when they're cut down with great ease. And people like Hope Not Hate, who are the ones behind these attacks, they're always the ones feeding the journalists this information. They're looking for people to scare, and they're hoping to create panic within the movement. So when you came back, when you said, no, I'm being defiant, that was exactly the opposite of what they wanted. And your channel's absolutely blossomed since then, because people can see you as an upstanding individual. And that's exactly what we need.
Well, I hope so. I mean, ideally, on the one hand, I wish I hadn't left Scotland. But on the other hand, I didn't have a support network in place. That was the thing. That was why I left. So it was... But I think the important thing was, I never thought oh, I'll have to give up. I'll have to stop. That never for a second occurred to me. All that occurred to me was that maybe I would lose the channel. So it would be, you know, like, whatever, taken out of my hands. And so, but I never thought, oh, I've got to stop now, because that's just ridiculous. I mean, the thing is, when they do that to you, they leave you with no option but to continue. In a way, this is because you can't have a normal life now. So you may as well just keep going. That's an irony. That's a sort of ironic thing about this.
Well, that's a very good point. And I think that's obviously the effect it had on you. Now, over the years, you know, I've been doing this 17 years, I've seen many, many people come and many, many people go, unfortunately. And not everyone's got the same resolve that you do. And they're obviously banking on some people, but when they pick on them, they are going to leave. And that's what they're hoping for. But I would like to think that we are facing such a incredible odds. We're facing the complete demographic annihilation of our people. And I would like to think that when Hope Not Hate do attack us, it galvanizes us. Now, I remember the recent ITV documentary that I was featured on. And, you know, before that, I said to everyone who were in my circles, I said, there's absolutely no way I'm attacking anyone. There's no way I'm disavowing anyone. There's no way I'm cooking out. There's no way I'm making apologies. And there's no way I'm going anywhere. And in fact, I'll defend anyone else who's on that show, because shows like that are just the same as sort of the doxing that you went through. They're designed for two reasons. Firstly, the first reason is they're made for the left. They're made for committed leftists to feel good about what they're doing. Leftists will be like, oh, yes, that completely vindicates my political position because these people are the bad guys. But these documentaries are also made for us. They're made for us to watch so that we look at each other and say, oh, well, you've done this and it's disgraceful. Well, I can't stand with you anymore. And they're made to sow seeds of division between us. And we can never allow that. We've got to always stand together. It's got to be the shield wall mentality. We've got to close ranks, because that's what the left are very good at doing. When the left do absolutely despicable things, and we don't do despicable things, we tell the truth. But when the left do despicable things, they close ranks. They never disavow. They never throw each other under the bus. And we've got to learn a lesson from them, because now is not the time for throwing fellow patriots or nationalists under the bus. We have to come together and stay strong. We have to present this shield wall, and we have to look after one another, because the one thing that we've lost, the one thing Western folk have lost, which is most important, is that sense of community. And we need to rebuild that community. We need a national community.
I absolutely agree. I mean, there has to be solidarity. And the thing is that the way they present you is so cartoonish and so lowbrow, so low grade. It shows that they're absolutely not interested in the truth. They don't give a shit. All they want is enough evidence to make you look terrible. And they'll pick only the stuff that makes you look terrible. And they'll be completely ruthless. I mean, they'll be merciless about it. And it's disgusting. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised at this stage. But it still does surprise me, because I think if they had any integrity at all, they would at least try to present a nuanced picture, you know, just for the sake of accuracy. But they don't. They don't give a shit about accuracy. It's all cartoonish villainizing of people who, you know, some of them are flawed, some of them are good, you know, whatever. People who are complex and people who have motivations, have reasons for doing what they do. And you could even, whatever, you know what I'm saying. It's just very simplistic and childish, and embarrassingly so. And of course, it surprises me that anyone like do take it seriously. I often wonder this. You know, like in my case with the Daily Record, that's a largely working class newspaper, the readership. And they bear the brunt of mass immigration. So if they see some vile racist on the front page, are they going to think, oh gosh, I better steer clear of his videos? Or are they going to think, all right, good that someone's on our side?
Well, I think that's one of the big things that the left get wrong, and they get it wrong time and time again. I mean, this is just a little bit of an anecdote from my time in the BNP, the British National Party. I designed this, it was a very, very big sort of billboard campaign, and it was British jobs for British workers. And obviously on the billboard campaign, there was a number that people could call. People could call this number to join the party. And the Daily Mirror ran this shock story that, you know, this racist party was running this campaign for British jobs for British workers. And they completely reproduced the billboard because they were trying to put pressure on the billboard company to take down the advertisement campaign. But this inadvertently had a fantastic effect for the party because there was a huge phone number in there. And we got dozens, if not hundreds, of calls from the general public who had actually seen the number in the Daily Mirror. They'd seen the number in the mirror and called it. And that's just, it does work well. And I think that for you, your channel absolutely ballooned after you were in the Daily Record. It was great publicity. Yeah, unfortunately,
I think I got 5,000 subscribers in like a week or 2 weeks after that. So it was just incredible.
Unfortunately, after the ITV documentary, I don't think anyone watched it because it was the most bizarrely named documentary I've ever seen. It was called Disclosure or something like that. It sounded more like a documentary about flashes than it did about the far right. And the actual footage was so poorly put together. It was on at about 10:45 when everyone's thinking about going to bed after the news. I don't think anyone actually watched it. I mean, Hope Not Hate must have really been disappointed because I think they only got about 30 likes on the program on their own Facebook. So it wasn't the big splash. And unfortunately, we didn't get loads of people looking at us. So, you know, but in a way, that's quite funny because the amount of time, effort and money that Hope Not Hate will have plowed into that to fail so dramatically, it fills my heart with joy.
Oh yeah, it's hilarious. But that, I mean, this is obviously a war, and they are quite. I mean, I imagine that they'll try similar tactics again. I think again that they've shown themselves to be really underhanded and immoral and ruthless. Of course, you never know if it's Hope Not Hate or some. More obscure Antifa outfit, or if it's the media themselves. At this stage, I think the lines between those things are incredibly blurry.
Oh, I completely agree that the lines are completely blurred. And you've got to remember, I was arrested and I stood trial for 8 counts of incitement to racial hatred. And when you look at the groups that colluded to bring about that trial, you've got the police, you've got the BBC, you've got Bradford Trade Union Congress, you've got Hope Not Hate. There's 4 groups, 2 of them explicitly left-wing, one of them explicitly anti-racist, one of them the state broadcaster, and the other the police, which is an arm of the state, all colluding to put me in jail for 8 counts of incitement to racial hatred. And for the record, I was found unanimously not guilty on all 8 counts. But when we're talking about these people, and we're talking about evil, and these people are evil, they are planning, people like Hope Not Hate are planning the genocide of the indigenous European people. For them, the end goal is multiculturalism, and multiculturalism and diversity is just the motor of white genocide. It's wiping our people out. That's what it's all about. So we can never see these people as decent human beings because essentially they are planning the most despicable crime against our people that has ever been planned. And the end goal of that plan is our annihilation.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. You know, they'll say that we are terrible for not wanting, you know, mass immigration, mass numbers of immigrants coming into Britain. And so they'll villainize us for that. They'll say that we are the most terrible things, terrible people, and yet to defend our own existence. That's all. I mean, it has nothing to do with hating darkies or something like that. We are trying to stand up for and preserve our existence as a people. They are plotting against us for doing that, and that's an occupation that busies them every single day. And I think, who are the villains here? And they are the ones who are secretly recording people, who are investigating people, who are probably on the phone all day, every day. trying to persuade this person to shut us down, that person to shut us down. Surely they are the villains here. They are the dishonest ones. They are the ruthless ones. And they are the shitty ones. And ultimately, as you see, they are the genocidal ones, because they're basically trying to lull the British public, in this case the British public, into a false sense of security such that they can be replaced and annihilated. I don't. What could possibly be worse than that? Now, I know that they would. I wouldn't be surprised if they're watching this and they quote from it. But I mean, what could be worse than that? You know, we know for a fact, statistically, that we are being demographically replaced. London's gone. Many smaller towns, the schools are majority non-white now. This is a statistical fact at this point. So. Isn't it just obvious that they are the people like Hope Not Hate and Antifa, they are the villains. They are the deranged ones here.
No, definitely. When I first got involved in nationalism, as I say, it was around the year 2000. Well, it was the year 2000. And there was a big thing at the time. One of the big sort of phrases, and I'm sure everyone will know what it is here, the 14 words, which are, we must secure an existence for our people and a future for white children. And those 14 words, to me, shouldn't be controversial. There should be no controversy in saying those words. To say that we are trying to secure an existence for those of European descent should not be controversial, just as it wouldn't be controversial for anyone to say that Australian Aborigines have a right to exist. But when you see how far their narrative has gone, you can see it in the It's Okay to Be White campaign, because the fact that it's okay to be white is now seen as a racist statement. It's a statement that causes such widespread outrage.
Oh yeah, not just a racist statement, but an outrageous statement. It's like, it's unacceptable.
Well, exactly. And the sort of it's okay to be white is almost like the new 14 words. It's saying it's okay for us to exist. You know, we want to exist. That's fine. But by saying it's not okay to be white, it sort of puts being white almost on a level of being a criminal, that it's wrong for us to exist. And if something's a criminal act, if something's wrong, you want to eliminate that. You want to reduce its occurrence. So by logical deduction, what these people are saying is that reducing our numbers, that getting rid of us, that exterminating us, that putting us to one side, to pushing us out of history, is a good thing, because it's not okay to be white. And one thing that really got me during that campaign was I saw people being interviewed on mainly American news segments, CNN, MSNBC, who were literally appalled, who were literally saying that they were scared when they saw these flyers, that they were terrified that people thought it was okay to be white. So these people weren't just saying it wasn't okay to be white, but they were actively scared that anyone in this day and age would stand up and say it was okay for white people to simply exist. And they've painted us really as the modern day devils, as these white devils, as these big bogeymen that everyone should fear. And I find that absolutely abhorrent, because at the end of the day, if you were to go out and look at things on a natural level, if you're talking about the preservation of a species of penguins or, you know, a species of fish or frogs, you would be a hero for preserving them. You'd be a hero for making sure they continue to exist. I mean, just look at the preservation of newts in this country. You know, you can't get a license to develop houses, which you shouldn't anyway, because we don't want to destroy the green belt. We don't want to destroy our wonderful forestry just for a bunch of immigrants to be able to be housed. You know, I'd much rather have foxes and trees than immigrants. But, you know, you can preserve the newts and you're a hero. But if you preserve the white race, you preserve the people who built the greatest civilization to ever exist, and you are de facto the devil.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible that this is where we are at this stage. Any other preservation is a good thing, and also the preservation of any other race is a good thing, except whites. We've somehow got to a position where white people have been lulled into believing this. Like, everything is good except their preservation as a people. Absolutely amazing. And I don't know, I think I would like to just emphasize that to the public over and over again, because I think it's so blatantly unfair and crazy and irrational. It'd be bad enough for us to be villainized anywhere in the world, but especially to ourselves in our own countries. You know, that's what's so amazing about this. Essentially, we've been put on a psychological course for annihilation, for self-destruction, so that we don't even want to exist. And that is truly a remarkable psyop that's been done on the white race.
No, I definitely agree with that. I mean, 1,000,000%. I mean, we have this horrible thing called white guilt, and the three central pillars of white guilt, I wrote about this in my book, you know, you've got the slave trade, you've got colonialism, and you've got the holy grail of white guilt, which is obviously the Holocaust. And all of these three historical occurrences are completely taken out of context, completely manipulated, and people are bombarded with slavery, colonialism, and the Holocaust from such a young age right through to their adulthood. And they are told that because of these three things, you've got to hate your ancestors were the bad guys, your forefathers were the bad guys. And the fact is, any race or any ethnicity that wishes to survive has to learn from their ancestors. They have to walk in the footsteps of their ancestors. They have to be at one with the past, and they have to move down the line that their ancestors laid out for them. So the big game plan here for our enemies is to make us hate our forefathers, to make us despise them, to make us not want to follow in their footsteps, to make us want to rebel against them, to make us want to throw off their traditions, their culture, their heritage, to make us want to tear down our own civilization. And this self-flagellation, this self-hatred, it's evident in all of these whites who don't think it's okay for themselves to exist. And because of this, you see so many whites, sadly, joining these groups like Hope Not Hate, joining Marxist groups, and literally wanting to see the destruction of their own people. And that's really is quite sick. That's almost a mental illness from my perspective. Because
and also it's like a drug as well. Because I've listened to people talking about the new film about Nelson Mandela or something like that. That's about 2 years ago now, and you can tell that they're looking forward to another dose off the drug, as it were, because it's what they know. So it's comforting to them. It's actually comforting for them to hear yet again that the white race is evil.
Well, of course. I mean, people may know I do indulge in a little bit of retro gaming, a bit of Super Nintendo now and again. But the white self-hate now is even in the gaming industry. I mean, look at the new Call of Duty, Call of Duty World War II. I did a meme about it on my Twitter account. I called it Call of Duty White Guilt Edition. Because that's what it is. You know, the developers proudly said, you know, we're going to go where no developer's gone before. We're going towards the Holocaust. You know, we want this story told. We want, you know, young people to play this game and go away from it with, you know, this particular historical perspective, so that the white guys are the bad guys. And then you look at games like Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus, you know, which is about essentially a group of communists, blacks, and white self-haters killing the Nazis. But as we all know, Nazi now is a coverall term for any white person who doesn't hate their own race. So essentially, these games are now pushing this horrible message of self-hatred and political correctness upon a whole new wave of youngsters. So if you don't get caught by the, you know, documentaries on the Discovery Channel, if you don't get caught by the twisted history books in school, if you don't get caught by the latest Spielberg film, you know, which has upped the kill count to 20 million in the Holocaust, you know, you're going to get caught by something. So they're going to put it in your computer games. And it's all a concerted effort. The people who have planned this are very, very clever. And their end goal, as I said earlier, is our annihilation. And what better way to destroy a people than to make them hate themselves? So ultimately, they are self-flagellating. So ultimately, the people act as their own prison wardens. They, you know, regulate what they say, they regulate their actions, And ultimately, they direct themselves towards their own end.
Oh, absolutely. On the matter, you said where no one has gone before. First of all, the funny thing about the flagellation to do with the Holocaust and the Nazis, the irony here is, you know, when I was small, it was the Nazis were bad. But nowadays, it's the Nazis were bad, and the people who fought them, the Allies, are also bad. You know, this is the funny thing. We now get tarnished with the same stuff that's attributed to the Nazis, even though we were fighting against the Nazis. I mean, there is no escape. there is no way to be a good white person except to be one who's basically race mixing. That really is the only way to be good nowadays. The other thing you said was about we're going to go where no one has gone before, and that reminded me of this new Star Trek thing. Did you happen to see the Star Trek Discovery series?
I haven't seen it yet.
All right. Is it as bad as everyone says?
Well, it's just pushing all the agendas, isn't it? And when you say the only good white person's a race-mixing white person, well, they have kind of like, what can you call it, the privilege Olympics, don't they? You know, they all squabble to be the least privileged. So if you're like, you know, a black, disabled, transgender with an adopted Somalian child who, you know, also has just one leg, you probably have the least amount of privilege. So you're like the best in society. But if you are a straight white male, then again, you're one of the white devils. You're one of the evil ones. So obviously this new Star Trek pushes this sort of, you know, privilege Olympics where it's this multiracial ship. It's, you know, got homosexual couples on. They're all living in this utopian society. And I'm sure later down the line, I'm not a big Star Trek fan, but if I was a betting man and I was watching the series, I'd just be waiting for the bad guys in the series or a group of bad guys to literally be kind of like the Star Trek version of the Third Reich, who obviously would have to be destroyed because they're homogenous, they're ordered, they're disciplined, they revel in their own traditions, and they would have to be brutally smashed by, you know, the utopian mix of all these different people who in the real world can never actually get on, because that's the one beauty of multiculturalism, is that it doesn't work. It is just a complete and utter failure. And everywhere it's been tried, it's failed completely, spectacularly. Like it's failing here. Like when you go to these Christmas markets, the biggest sign of the failure of multiculturalism is that you can't take your child to see Santa Claus without going through metal barriers, past concrete barricades, and, you know, making sure that there's armed guards either side of Santa Claus just in case things start falling to pieces. Because, you know, despite them saying diversity is our greatest strength, society is literally falling to pieces now. You're getting to the point where it affects everyone. Because at one time, you know, terrorism was something that was a little bit abstract. You know, government buildings were protected by armed police. You know, airports were protected by armed police. Now, the mulled wine stall at the local Christmas market is protected by armed police, and it's affecting everyone's lives.
Oh, yeah. I shared a meme the other day. I think it was Merry Multicultural Christmas, and it showed a huge Christmas tree, obviously in some town in England, and it had two armed police, like they had huge, rifles of some kind, standing at the base of it. And it's like, it's surreal, you know, because to think like 50 years ago, if you'd said to people 50 years ago in Britain, how does this look to you? I think they would have been absolutely baffled. Like, why on earth would a Christmas tree in some town in England need to be protected by armed police? This is incredible. Sorry, you go.
No. Sorry, I wasn't going to add anything there. I was just sort of really. What can I add to that? It's completely true. I mean, we've been everything that we've built is being given away, and we're becoming second class citizens. You know, and everything that we hold dear. You see, freedom, security, trust, those things come from a homogenous community. They come from people who have the same aims, the same history, the same past, the same future, ultimately. That builds a cohesive community. And the big problem is, whites have been atomized, but at the same time as we've been atomized, we've brought these people into our country. Well, we haven't. The internationalists have and their puppet politicians have. And these people don't share the values that our ancestors shared. And as we're this atomized mass that can't protect ourselves, the people who are coming here, the people who look at us with envious eyes, the people who pose a threat to us, they've retained their cohesion and they are a huge threat to the atomized mass of European people. And that's why we exist, though. That's the wonderful thing. And that's what I want to achieve. And I'm sure that's what you want to achieve, is bring our people back together so that we can stand as a cohesive force against these threats and hopefully turn back the tide before it's too late.
Oh, absolutely. The thing about having, I think that the thing you hit on there is that we're a united people, the same past, same present, and ultimately the same future. That is so important. It's this thing about, I mean, obviously we can talk about the past and our ancestral identity and the thousands of stories that make up the identity that each white person has today, but also the future. If you think that you have no future together, that literally your people has no future, then of course you are going to be atomized. Just in response to that, you're going to sort of crawl in back into your shell as an individual, because it's like a defense mechanism against the fact that you have no future together. It's like, it's better just to be atomized so that you don't feel the loss. You know, it's better just to be an atomized individual who has no group identity at all than to exist as one of the white race that is, scheduled for extinction. It's better just to join the atomized masses and not care about this anymore. And I think that nihilism is now what characterizes young British people. The baby boomers completely take for granted the comfort that they've had. And I don't want to hate on the baby boomers too much, but it does occur to me when I speak to them, just how much they don't understand about the present situation. They think it's all, people like us, they think that we're just wrong and deluded and paranoid or joking. You know, I think they don't understand. No, you, all your lives have had this, the comfort of living in a white society and with a white identity that you completely took for granted and were able to throw to the four winds, really.
I think the issue with baby boomers and the thing that gets me about them and us and the different generations is quite simply the housing market. That's the big separation. You see, what made it very easy for them is they left school, they went into their father's industry, they got good jobs, those jobs were well paid, there was usually a structure in those working environments, and they could buy houses. You know, you hear people saying, oh, I bought a lovely three-bedroom house back in the day for £40,000, and you look at them, what? £40,000 would probably be a deposit on a nice three-bedroomed house in some parts of the country. And that's the big thing. The big thing, big difference, is they had it very easy to buy a home. And the old saying, an Englishman's home is his castle. Well, it is in many ways, and it's something you can be proud of. Well, they've had the pride of owning their own home. They've had their little space. We don't have that. We don't have that luxury. I know people, I don't live at home, but I know people well into their 30s who still live at home. And they're struggling. They're struggling. And they don't even have much in the way of savings. If they did meet a partner and want to move out, they couldn't do it. And that's the big difference. It's very hard for our generation, especially for people younger than you and I, to be upwardly mobile. And I think it's that lack of struggle to get on the housing market, that ability to have a place in the world, that has made these baby boomers think differently. And they were never on this horrible sort of meat grinder that we're on, where everything is so difficult, where financially things aren't as easy. We can't just buy our place in the world. And I think also that leads to people thinking, well, sod it, I'm going to live a life of hedonism. If I can't get on the housing market, if I can't, make these investments, if I can't get my own family, if I can't do what my parents did, sod it, I'm just going to go out and have fun. And they end up following this path of hedonism, and hedonism is absolutely destructive. It's absolutely terrible. It's a blight upon our people.
And because of the extremes here, it's really one thing or the other. You can't be a hedonist who does have a family. It's and a house and, you know, all that. It's really one thing or the other. And I think you're absolutely right. This reality, it has just arrived. Yeah, it's just sort of enveloped our generation. I hardly know anyone who has their own house. In fact, I can't actually think of anyone of my age, my age group, who has their own house. It's quite remarkable, really.
No, it's a sad reflection of our times. It's a sad reflection of our times. And as I say, there's a lot of pride in owning a home. But again, the problems here come from immigration. Everything stems from this immigration. You know, why are house prices soaring? Well, house prices are soaring because they're becoming more and more and more of a commodity. Because the more people you have, the more demand there is for housing. And the more demand there is for any commodity, the more the price rises. And supply is going to get more and more limited because we live in a world of finite resources. We can't just keep building houses. We can't just keep finding places to build upon because we are becoming so overcrowded. Now, I know it's not as bad in Scotland where you are, in parts of Wales, but England is one of the most overcrowded nations on the planet. We are just packed in like sardines. And especially if you live in a place like London, you know, where you've got the added problem of all these sort of Arab sheikhs and foreign investors buying up the prime property, there literally isn't going to be anywhere for our people. And in a way, that takes us back to what we were talking about earlier, about, you know, white genocide, about the destruction of our people. This is another part of the loss of the indigenous people of this country's birthright. Their birthright was a patch of this land. Their birthright was living in the house of their forefathers and carrying on that tradition. But they're being robbed of that. They are being reduced to peasants in a land where they should be kings.
Well, indeed. I remember when Richard Briers died, and James Dellingpole wrote an article about him, and he said it had made him think about the differences in, well, now from the 70s, because he was thinking about The Good Life, the sitcom that Richard Briers was in. And in those days, the character was a draftsman in London who had a house in Surbiton. And James Dellingpole pointed out that you could not have a house in Surbiton today on the salary of a draftsman. You'd be living in a one-bedroom apartment or something in London. You would not have your own house, and you'd be renting. So it's a totally different thing. I mean, I used to watch a lot of TV drama from the 70s, and of course, that seems to be like the last gasp of something of a semi-traditional Britain. And you see this a lifestyle that is. I mean, when I was growing up, I was watching these things, and but it's slowly faded away, such that today it's just another world. You know, the comfort of a largely white Britain, the wife stays at home, the kids, that there are two kids, three kids, the father works a job, and that's enough for him to support his family, and a nice house. And that has just totally gone. And I really, you know, nowadays, of course, it's not just the economic stuff, it's also the cultural stuff. Nowadays, you'd be preparing for, you know, one of the kids would be going into, I don't know, trans therapy or something. Another kid would be gay and all the rest of it. And the mother would be having an affair with a lesbian. Well, I mean, it's just crazy. The kaleidoscope that has opened up over the last 20 years. I mean, it's obviously been on the cards for a lot longer than that, but it seems to have really ramped up in the last 20 years. And certainly when you look back 40 years, it's just another world.
I completely agree. I mean, in my book, I talk about the family unit, and all of this is fundamentally an attack on that, you see, because any successful community, any successful society, any successful group of people on whatever level is underpinned by their ability to start a family. And the power of successful families builds successful civilizations. And we as Europeans, because of where we evolved, because of our natural environment and the harshness of our natural environment at this time of year. I mean, we're on late tonight. We're half an hour late because it snowed today. You know, we get 6 to 10 inches of snow in some parts of Britain today, and it affects life. Now, if you're a man and a woman with a child, you have to come together in that environment in a natural world to look after that child. We've been doing this whole family thing for close to 40,000 years. It's ingrained in our society and it underpins our society. It's the fundamental, the traditional family is the fundamental building block of the West. And this attack that you were talking about then, this attack on the family, ripping the family to pieces, perverting the family, making the family anything but the traditional family, is the most fundamental attack on our people, because that's the beginning of our atomization. And if you look at groups like the Muslims who are coming here, who are essentially affecting our society in such a way, people say, look, they're a cohesive group, they stick together. But ultimately, look what is at the heart of their group. It is still the family. It is still the loving mother. It's still the father. It's the well-behaved and obedient children. We don't have that anymore. And often what really sickens me and saddens me is when you see families breaking up because one or both parts of the coupling decide to go their separate ways to seek hedonism because they can't see it working because of these financial pressures, because of the pressures to be materialistic, because of the pressures to pursue things that they shouldn't be pursuing. And they're not looking at the fundamental reason they got together, which is, you know, love and to bring up children in a stable and happy home. And once you break that stable and happy home, unfortunately, the children don't grow up in a stable environment, and that affects them mentally.
Indeed. And this is all about stability. I mean, that's ultimately what marriage was for. It was to create a stable environment for kids. Nowadays, we're trained not to want kids and not to want stability. We're supposed to want endless development and exploration throughout our entire lives. But I actually think that people simply aren't built for that. You know, it's something that tempts them. It sounds good. But especially women, I think, just get totally burned out by that. But, you know, by the time they're 40, and then they're very bitter. But on the matter of the attack on the family, my friend has a channel, Pale Hominid, and he did a fantastic analysis of a pizza advert. This is like a year ago, 2 years ago now. And I've always remembered this because it was incredible. He's American, and it was a pizza advert on American TV. I forgot what it was called. But anyway, he pointed out that it was a white family, and it showed them through the decades, I think from 1980 to 1990, and then the woman in the present day. It was like, so she was a wee girl in 1980, then she was a teenager in 1990, and then she was a grown woman with kids of her own in 2010, whatever it was. And it was very interesting because the white family, the father was portrayed as a buffoon, and the mother was portrayed, this is in the 1980, as just a housewife who didn't get much recognition from the father. He took it all for granted. And then in 1990, the girl was a teenager, and she resented the father, resented her brother, and the brother was then portrayed as sort of arrogant. And then in 2010, the woman, she's now a grown woman, and she's with she's with a half black guy. And I mean, my friend pointed out was it was ridiculous that a pizza advert was, I mean, of all things, this is about a pizza, right? This is to advertise a pizza. And in the olden days, a pizza advert on TV in the 80s or something would want to target its the main demographic of the country, which is white Americans. And it would want to not flatter them. Well, yeah, it would want to flatter them by showing them a nice version of themselves. But it would also want them to give them something to aspire to, just to make them in a good mood, you know? And so it would show them a nice white American family. But instead, what they do now is show you a dysfunctional American family in which everyone resents each other and takes each other for granted. And I just think that was a really good point, because it shows, well, frankly, I think they put ideology before profit at this stage. You're actually insulting your target demographic and telling them that their home life is shitty. And yeah, so what's being delivered there?
Well, I'm really pleased you raised this because this nicely segues into the whole Christmas advert debacle here in the UK. And as you know,
indeed, you and I both made videos about that. Your one got taken down.
My one got banned. Yeah, my one got banned because it was a little bit too satirical, maybe. And I genuinely believe that I was really hitting a nerve with that video. But one thing that I said in my analysis, the video's up on minds.com. I've got an account now on BitChute and minds.com. So if you want to go and watch my Christmas adverts video, please do that. There was two sort of underlying things that I really pointed out. The first was miscegenation. In all these Christmas adverts, the Debenhams advert, the Marks and Spencers advert, the Tesco advert, the Morrison's advert, and there's other adverts that I didn't talk about, the eBay advert. There's other adverts that I didn't talk about, like the Studio advert, the new Apple advert, and all of these adverts had this underlying thing that basically white women should go with black men. And that is the best thing ever. You know, if a white woman goes with a black guy, that is completely normal. And the John Lewis advert, that was another one that had a mixed race family. And it was pushing the idea that that is the desirable social norm. But the other idea is something that you touched upon that the adverts love to push as well, that the white families or the white male are either bad, buffoonish, dysfunctional. So like in the Tesco advert, the multicultural family, they're the good ones. So like the Muslims who are giving each other Christmas presents, because this is obviously one of these fantasy utopias that doesn't exist. They're obviously cohesive and they're hugging each other, exchanging presents. The black family, you know, they're getting on well. Well, it's a mixed race family. They're all getting on well, and they're eating their dinner. But the white families, they're all idiots. So the woman, she can't get the turkey to fit into the oven, so she's ramming it into the top shelf, and the potatoes are flying everywhere because she's a complete idiot, because she's white, you know, and the joke's always on the white family. But it was even worse in the M&S advert that starred Paddington Bear, because that was utterly sickening. You've got this white thief, this white man who's a thief, and Paddington Bear sort of inadvertently stops him in the midst of his thieving of all the people's Christmas presents, and he mistakes him for Santa, and he takes him on this bumbling journey around this sort of idyllic town to deliver all the presents he's stolen. So they have this little journey, and this journey ends at this house where him, the thief, the reformed thief, and Paddington Bear look into the window, and they're observing this mixed race family, a black man, a white woman, and their mixed race kids. And they're having the most idyllic and perfect Christmas. And the motto of the story is the black man and the white woman, they live in a utopian world. But the white man, he's out in the cold, in the snow, and he literally sheds a tear as he looks on longingly at the white woman as she embraces her mixed race daughter. And that is a really, really very well thought out. I've got to hand it to them. Very well thought out, but highly insidious message. And these adverts are all pushing this shocking message. And the end game of it is always the same. It's that white women should mix with non-whites, should date non-whites, should marry non-whites, should have non-white children, because that's all part of the white genocide plan. And ultimately, they know that that will be accelerated exponentially if they can fill all the white wombs with non-white children.
It was absolutely incredible. You know, this year, I think that advert you just described, did it not cost £7 million? I think one of them cost £7 million.
That was the John Lewis one, which was just 15.
Okay. Yeah, well, the uniformity of all these adverts this year was really striking. I think they've never been this... It's never been this glaring before. You know, you'd have one or two of them that would do this, but now it's like, is it seven or eight of them this year? And all of the main ones as well. The only one that didn't do it was Waitrose. But it didn't portray a family. It just portrayed a community. But of course, that's a similar thing. It was remarkable because I think there was one black guy in it. But other than that, everyone was white. And that was what it really struck me as. It was actually a really nice advert. I liked it. But it stood at a mile in this crop of Christmas adverts this year because it didn't promote miscegenation. I mean, it's actually as I say it, it's just incredible. An advert that doesn't promote miscegenation is now an oddity. It's now the unusual thing. And I think that there did seem to be a controversy among the general public in Britain, although I wasn't, and I'm not in Britain, so I don't know exactly how widespread that was. But I saw newspaper articles about the fact that there was an uproar at all these race mixing Christmas adverts, and it wasn't just us. You know, it wasn't just nationalists who were moaning about it. I think it actually did. It was so obvious this year that even the general public noticed.
Well, Tesco's got a huge blowback for theirs, and so did some of the other stores. I mean, eBay, their advert got absolutely slated. I mean, their advert was with the quirky sort of, you know, she's not unattractive, but she's, you know, quirky girl, and she's buying all her stuff off eBay, and then she's got a pink tree, which is curiously topped with a black star. So you've got a pink tree with a black star on top, and then, you know, all of a sudden it cuts to sort of like a slate of text. And then she jumps up and goes, ta-da, to reveal her black boyfriend. And the final slate of it all is, fill your cart with color. Now, if there's not some sexual innuendo in there, well, there is. I mean, blatantly, that is a sexual innuendo. Fill your cart with color. Because I've never heard anyone go shopping and say, oh, I'm off to fill my cart with color. I'm off to buy some color.
Yeah.
They don't say
it
that.
Doesn't really make sense.
No, it doesn't. That's the point. It doesn't make sense. But there has been huge blowback. And if you look at all the YouTube videos, all these Christmas adverts, and I listed them, I think, you know, I listed them in my, in the description of my video. And I politely suggested to people that they went and, you know, told these companies in a polite manner, of course, what they thought of them and, you know, carried out a boycott of these companies. You know, I will not shop, definitely not in, you know, stores like Debenhams, Marks and Spencers, John Lewis. I won't even set foot in them, because if they're going to push the destruction of my people, they're not getting my patronage. And the fact is, we can have a say, we can take money away from them, and nothing would make my Christmas warmer and happier than seeing these big anti-white capitalist corporations have an absolutely torrid Christmas where they don't make any money. I want to see the high street beaten down this Christmas because of the filth they've pushed, because these people have to pay one way or another. And if we hit them in the wallet, that's what hurts them the most, because there's one thing they probably love more than this twisted anti-white ideology, and that's the shekels. So if we can make sure that the shekels don't go in the coffers, we're doing a great service to our people, and we're kicking them exactly where it hurts.
Well, absolutely. I remember looking at one of the, I think it was the Morrison's advert, but I'm not sure now. I can't recall. But it was just relentless, the comments. I mean, it was, there were, I think there were like one or two comments saying, oh, this is such a nice advert. And then all the others, it was just people saying, do we have to have so many fucking race mixing adverts? And people really noticed. I mean, it was unrelenting, and I was very glad. It was so reassuring to think that, right, so many people can see it. Thank God. I mean, in a way, this is how it is becoming now. The propagandists are ramping it up to such a degree that they're giving it away. They're giving the game away. It's becoming clumsy. And also, not only the prevalence of race mixing, but the fact that it's always a white woman with a black guy, that is, you know, if they were actually to be more clever about it, they would vary that a bit more. The fact is, it's virtually always a white woman with a black guy. And that immediately tells you that cannot be a coincidence. Yeah, there has to be a reason why it's always that combination. I mean, obviously there are exceptions, but not many. And I think, again, that people, that is supposed to hit people quietly, but instinctively. And instead, I think it's hitting them quite loudly. They're noticing it. So that is a good thing. I mean, God knows what the Christmas adverts will be like next year.
Well, I think when you look at the miscegenation issue, that is one of my sort of that's one of the being the longest standing points as a nationalist. You know, when I first got involved 17 years ago, that was one of the underlying points, and it's still here today. Because when you look at miscegenation, it's one of the things that's relentlessly pushed. It's pushed by the media. It's pushed by Hollywood. It's pushed by the press. It's pushed by the advertising agencies. It's pushed in soap operas. It's pushed in books, you know, and now we've got it being pushed by the royal family. You know, that's going to be a huge issue. You know, I saw you did a excellent video on Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, and this is going to be used to give the royal stamp of approval to having, you know, mixed race children. And that's very unfortunate, because it's almost going to be used as another, well, it will be used as another stick with which to beat us with, to make people think it's trendy. It's going to be cool. You know, the effect the royals have on people, if they name their baby,
oh, yeah,
you know, something, everyone names their baby that, you know, they named their little girl, you know, William and Kate named their girl Charlotte. And there was a huge surge in people naming their baby Charlotte. Well, this is going to popularize miscegenation, which is a bad thing. And our enemies understand that the future of our people lies in the wombs of our women. That is where, you know, you can have one man survive, but if he's got 100 women, you can carry on. But unfortunately, you can have 1 million white men, but if there's only 10 white women left, if there's only 10 white wombs left, you're finished. And that's why the relentless attack is always to push white women to go with non-white men, or primarily to push white women to go with non-white men, because it's a matter of womb space. It's why when you look at the Jewish people, they say, to be a Jew, your mother has to be a Jew, because they understand that the future of their people lies in the wombs of Jewish women. And again, that is why they push this nonsense on white women. And this has been going on for years. I mean, I remember quite a while ago now, Dr. William Pierce did an excellent discussion on a film called Save the Last Dance, which was prominent at the time because it was a film that heavily pushed miscegenation. It was a film about a beautiful young white ballerina who goes to live in the hood and ends up with a black ghetto sort of R&B dancer. And that's been relentlessly pushed. And the message is always the same, that the black man, he's the alpha, he's powerful, he's manly, he's a proper male. Whereas the white man, he's the bad guy, he's a bit of a wimp, he's a bit of a cuck, he's a bit of a beater. So the women who are left, who actually have got some form of wish to go out there and go for an alpha male, unfortunately, they're not looking for white men. And that presents us with a huge, huge problem. And you couple that with the huge number of immigrants coming here, their birth rate, the fact they breed so quickly, and then the fact that white people aren't breeding and increasingly white women are being pushed to going with non-white men, it is a demographic nightmare. This is what they're doing.
And especially considering that these non-white men, a lot of them are not nervous about approaching white women at all. I mean, very much the opposite. We've imported a virile block of people. And it's that applies to blacks and to Muslims especially, I would say. And they are not nervous about approaching white women. They know exactly what to do. They know how to do this. And at the same time, you've got the feminizing of white men. This is why, you know, if you think about Sweden, is it really surprising that so many Swedish women go with Muslim guys? Because Swedish men have been so utterly weakened and cucked and degraded. I mean, they're so reasonable, they're so middle class, they're so white, that unfortunately at a certain point that becomes extremely debilitating when there are lots of non-whites in your society, because suddenly the virtues that used to mean that guy could get along in a Swedish society, that guy could have a job and be respected in his neighbourhood and so on in his white Swedish society, those same virtues, well, those same qualities now mean that he is a fucking wimp in the face of a Muslim thug who wants to. And so then, well, what are the women going to feel safe with? Not the intelligent, educated, middle class Swedish cuck. They're going to feel safe with the Muslim thug.
Well, it goes, goes deeper than that, though, as well, doesn't it, really? It's like Islam still presents sort of a strong and traditional life. It presents something that people can cling to, a value system.
Indeed. And when I say Muslim thug, I mean, there's no need to demonize Muslims. What they're doing is they're simply doing what men are supposed to do, which is to, you know, approach women and be confident and tell them, I want to make you a mother. I want you to be the mother of my children. I want to marry you. You know, I've heard from quite a lot of white women who've said that this has been said to them by coloured men of one kind or another, mostly Muslims. Whereas white men are trained to, and again, in an all-white society, it's fine if white men are like this. White men have been trained to take it slow, be overbearing, don't be imposing, be gentle with her, and so on. That is fine when there are no non-white men competing with different rules. But when there are, what happens is that white women get approached, and that then is far more exciting for them than some white guy who never makes the move.
No, I completely agree with that. And what I used to call this, this might amuse a few people, I used to call this the asylum seeker dating technique. If you go into a nightclub in the UK, you will see groups of asylum seekers. You can identify them by their sort of brown leather jackets and, you know, Rockport shoes, and their kind of like their general look and demeanor. And they have this technique where they will walk up to a girl and they'll proposition them, and the girl will usually say no. But they do this shamelessly, and they will walk up to 100 girls. Now, if you're playing the odds and you say, well, only 1% of women in that club would sleep with them, they will walk up to 100 girls easily that night and proposition 100 girls. So they always end up going home with a woman. Whereas white guys, they will spend all night sat in the corner looking at one girl, plucking up the courage to talk to her. And if they go up to that girl and she rebuts them, that's him done for the night. He'll sit in the corner, he'll feel a bit bad about himself, he'll feel a bit self-conscious and like he's, you know, let himself down, he'll feel embarrassed. And unfortunately, he shouldn't feel that way. He should just dust himself off and go and speak to the next. And that's why we're being outstripped, because these people are confident, whereas our people have had the confidence beaten out of them. And I don't really want to get into a huge thing about this, but I think the whole miscegenation thing is obviously why there's been this sort of like trouble over the last few days, and why there has been kind of like this sort of division over the whole Lauren Southern thing. But I really want to make myself clear on this. Like, the reason I did a video on this. The reason I'm upset with her is not necessarily because she did it. I don't like the fact she did it, but she didn't apologize for doing it. She's not turned her back on that. Now, believe me, everyone makes mistakes. And people who know me, I've made some real mistakes in my life. I've made a complete dick of myself at times. And I can stand up and say, yeah, I've made errors. And that's, I make a lot of videos on this, and I talk to a lot of young people, and I want to help young people make sure they don't make the same mistakes as me. But to me, I believe in this movement being a big tent where there's men, where there's women, and where women are at the forefront of this movement with us, because we need traditional people, both male and females. We need good people, good women and good men to lead us forward. And we need good women to attract other good women, and we need good men to attract other good men. But if we sort of tolerate people in this movement who are unrepentant in the negatives they've done wrong, that's what upsets me. You see, if a girl comes to me and says, look, Mark, I was brought up to believe all that was right, and I did go with a black guy in the past, but I see that's wrong now, I'm not going to cast her to one side. I'm not going to say you've got no place in this movement. Of course I'm not. If a woman comes to me who's had abortions, a woman comes to me who's been a stripper, been in the porn industry even, or done drugs, I'll welcome them if they turn their backs on the negative past. Just like I welcome lots of young men who've been addicted to porn, who've been addicted to drugs, who, you know, have done the wrong things, who've been unfit, been unhealthy, not lived productive lives, maybe been hedonists, materialists. We need everyone on our side. But to come into our movement, we have to have a moral standard. And as I said, I want a big tent, but to come into the tent, you have to acknowledge,
say the 14 words.
Yeah,
yeah, really, I can
generously into the tent. And people have been talking about this in the chat, and that's the only reason I brought it up. I think me and Millennial Woes here, we largely agree on this. And I'm not going to sit here and argue with him. He made a great video on it. And we are largely in agreement that we need good traditional women in the movement. But, and as I said, I'd be happy if Lauren Southern makes a video tomorrow saying that she rejects race mixing now, she rejects miscegenation. I'll make a video tomorrow saying, great, I take back my previous video, you know, come into the club with us. But we have to have morals, and that the center of that morality has to be,
I agree. I think this is the crux of the matter, that Lauren Southern has not said, I regret it. And so, you see, the trouble for her is she has the talent and the charisma and the looks to, I mean, she could be on Fox News or something. And so that is an understandable dilemma for her. Either she can go ethno-nationalist and join us, or she can not come out against race mixing and she could have a mainstream career. So, it's selfish, of course, but, everyone is. And that is a balance of factors that will be going on in her head just now. Obviously, I hope that she chooses to come out as an ethno-nationalist. I think she should. I think the time is right. I think that all the others have. So I think she should. I hope she does. What I was saying in my video was that I was not talking about... Well, I was saying that, you know, we've all made mistakes, and she was 16 when she did that, and she grew, and you know, you can say, well, you're just making excuses for her, but these are just facts. She was 16. She grew up in a heavily, libtard city, which is very multiracial. She was friends with the guy. It was not some kind of leap to, oh, I'll go with a mixed race guy, or I'll go with a black guy. She was friends with him. So it would have been one of those things that would have happened very naturally. And then later, only later, when she'd grown up, would she have thought, that was a thing I did there. So that's what I was trying to emphasize, that you should try to see it from her point of view before saying that she's a coal-burning mud shark or something, or a race-mixing whore. I mean, these terms are obviously very derogatory, and you know, these are real. Again, as I said in the video, we have to deal with life as it actually is, not as we would like it to be in a traditionalist white society. Unfortunately, we're not in that situation. But I do understand. For God's sake, I wasn't happy when I heard the news. I understand perfectly why people are disappointed in her. I think that she's at. This has brought to the fore that, well, she has to make a choice. And if she goes the Fox News route, then, you know, I won't defend her again, even though I would understand that, you know, selfish decision. And alternatively, if she comes out as an ethno-nationalist, like Faith Goldie has, like Brittany Pettibone has, like Blonde in the Belly of the Beast has, like Tana McCarthy has, like Lauren Rose has, then that's that, as far as I'm concerned. And I think at that point, we would have to be careful in discouraging people from continuing to bother her with this, if she were to come out as an ethno-nationalist. It's one thing or the other, really. Unfortunately, it is black and white.
Yeah, definitely.
And for the decision's up to her.
Yeah, and it's about, like I said, I want to win, and I know we need numbers and we need good people. And if people have made mistakes, I'm just reiterating, I am tolerant of that, and I am happy to forgive people for making mistakes. But we cannot have great heresies tolerated in the movement just because a girl is sort of relatively attractive and some men, you know, covet her, you know. And I don't understand why people are so precious about her when we have so many amazing women. Just look at, like, Brie Fichet. She's an incredible woman. Go and check her channel out. Please sub her channel. Lauren Rose. I mean, I couldn't believe she was 19, because her talking points, her verbal abilities are amazing. Look at Faith Goldie. She is beautiful. She is erudite. She dresses wonderfully. She presents herself so well. Tara McCarthy. You know, she's a very, very brave woman. She has brilliant verbal abilities. She talks about race and IQ, things that a lot of men are scared to talk about. You know, we have people like Wife with a Purpose. She was incredible when she came on this week in the alt-right. We have Blonde in the Belly of the Beast. We have all these people who are coming out doing great things. And they're the women we need. And we do need good women. Women will broaden our appeal. They'll make us mainstream, and they'll bring in other good women. And we need good women because we need that womb space. That's what we're talking about. But we don't need people who aren't going to embrace our core values. And we certainly don't need people who are going to be rude to us. And when she said that anyone that disagrees with her is essentially autistic. And the other thing that got me was like, what she said that what she did wasn't wrong because basically he voted Trump. So essentially, yeah, if you sleep with a black guy in a MAGA hat, it's cool. You know, that to me, it's not cool.
Yeah.
Because as I said, you know, civic nationalism is just multiculturalism in MAGA hats, and it's not good. But, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There's that meme of the, this is what liberals want, and it's a woman with 10 mixed race kids. And then it says, this is what civic nationalists want, and it's the same photo, but they've all got the MAGA hat on.
But I'm so pleased we talked about this. I'm so, because it shows that like people wanted drama tonight. I could see some people in the chat wanted drama, and the fact that we found this sort of common ground and we both agree, there's no drama here, guys. We're all on the same side, and we're all fighting for what's right, which is a future for our people. Me and my good friend here, we're not going to roll around in the dirt, knocking each other's teeth out over this woman. If she can't sort of abide by our core moral values, me and my friend here, we'll have a beer, we'll have a laugh, and we'll carry on fighting for our race in the only way that we can, which is what we've been doing for so long. You know, we're all friends here, and we're all fighting for the same thing. So, you know, there's no drama.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, this is obviously an upset, but it's one that will be put behind us, and we'll just keep going. And as for Lauren Southern, the choice is hers, and I hope she comes around to our way of thinking. That's yet to be seen. So I suppose I did want to talk to you about the alt-right and comparing it with your days in the BNP, but I think we're almost out of time. So that's something that we'll maybe have to talk about on a different occasion. Is there anything else that you want to talk about just before we wrap up?
Yeah, I want, what I was going to say about the BNP, I'll be very brief, is we were a real world movement, and the alt-right is very internet based. And in 2018, I would love you to help me do this. You're a great man, you've got a great audience, and you're a role model for so many people. And I would love you to help me bring the alt-right in the UK off the internet and into the real world. I'm doing a competitive assault course in May 2018. I would love, you know, so many of you to join with me to get fit, to come and do it. It doesn't have to be a competition, you know, do it as a team. You know, we need to get together. We need to have meetings. We need to have book clubs. We need to relate to each other in the real world. We need to support each other. And we need to do the one thing that, you know, we as a people aren't doing anymore. And that's come together as a community. We need to build a genuine alt-right real world community. And I would love to join here with Millennial Woes to have meetings, to hold events, to do things that mean that we forge real world bonds, and we can start building that community. We can start bringing people together so we can build that shield wall. And I would love to have you with me at that assault course. I'd love to train with you. I'd love to, you know, hold a book club with you. I'd love to have meetings with you. And I'd love to get everyone in the chat, all your wonderful viewers, all the people who watch my channel, and I'd like to bring us all together in that big tent. And when we're all together in the real world in that big tent, we can make a big noise, and we can make big changes, and we can start to build a movement that is genuinely going to save the European people and ensure a future for our progeny.
Absolutely. I think that 2018 will be, I mean, this year has been a lot of upsets and interferences with the movement in one way or another. I think that 2018, we will have learned these lessons. We will have built up defences and devised tactics for dealing with these attacks. And I think that we will start to move off the internet and into the real world. Because after all, so many people say I get emails all the time. Do you know how I can meet people, other alt-righters, other nationalists, other identitarians in my area? And of course, I don't. So we need to build that network. And I think it's essential and it's inevitable. And I think it is. Certainly, I think that by this time next year, we will have definitely started that. I think that we will definitely have made inroads into that, and people will have noticed a difference. But of course, it's not for you and me to do that alone. Other people need to chip in and do their bit as well, because this is not entertainment. This is not a hobby. This is a community and a subculture. And you can help as well, and you should help as well. So this is definitely the work of 2018, I think. As much as, I mean, I have other things to do as well, but this is something that I think the community as a whole should address. We should start rescuing ourselves, because too many people think, well, that if I don't do a video on this, like if Millennial Woes doesn't do it, then, well, the alt-right's just a load of shit. What incompetence. Well, no, you make the video on it. And so on. I don't need to go through other examples of the same thing. But this is, you know, building a network of in the real world is going to require a lot of people to offer their services, their time, and so on. But it's absolutely worth it, because in the end, we will have a real-life network of people who can support and defend, and in extreme circumstances, even protect each other. So. Absolutely. Let's do that.
Well, I've got a busy 2018 planned. Most of all, I need to find a wife and have some white children, because otherwise it's all going to be in vain. But I also need to join up with all you good people, all the good people in the audience, people like Millennial Woes, because I want to have children, but I want a future for those children. I want them to grow up in a world where they have a future, where they're not second-class citizens, where they are the masters of their own destiny, where they grow up in their forefathers' house and inherit a civilization worth inheriting. And that, to me, is where my real passion is. But I believe we can do this. I have never, in my whole 17 years of being involved, I've never lost faith that we're going to win. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to win, but I believe we are going to win. And one day we're going to stand together and the sun will be shining and the birds will be tweeting and we can raise a glass and we can hail victory and we can toast to a future for our people, our kids. And let's make 2018 the start of that. I've really enjoyed being here tonight. I just want to thank you for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure. I really hope you'll join us one time on This Week on the Alt-Right, because it'd be an absolute pleasure to have you on. You're a great inspiration to our people, and the work you're doing is absolutely important. It's great. And you really have helped to red pill so many people. It's been absolutely wonderful. And I'd also like to thank the audience. Thank you for being here, and thank you for all your support. You know, we couldn't, neither me nor Millennial Woes could do what we do without your wonderful support. And believe me, things are difficult sometimes. Things get you down. Things that sometimes it feels like everything's going against you when you're doing what we're doing. But when we wake up, well, for me anyway, I'm sure it's the same for Millennial Woes, but when I wake up and I see these lovely comments, get these lovely messages, see all your support, see you, you know, behind us. Honestly, that is the wind that carries us forward. Your support makes what we do possible. And, you know, people often look to us for inspiration. Well, you guys are an inspiration to me. So thank you for your wonderful support.
Yes, I would echo that sentiment. Okay, well, excellent. That's been a really good chat. I'm sorry that it began a bit late, but we got there in the end. So hold on, I've actually forgotten who's on next. Sorry about this. I think it's Elon. Yeah, it's Critical Condition next. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you, Mark, and I will try to appear on This Week in the Alt-Right soon. It's just purely been how busy I am that's prevented me from accepting your offer before now. So, excellent. Let's call it a day there. Thank you, Mark Collett. To everyone for listening. See you again soon.